Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, September 17th, 2024. We begin on the front page with Federal Trial Latest Test for Illinois Gun Ban by Jeremy Gorner with the Chicago Tribune. Legal wrangling over Illinois' sweeping gun ban resumed Monday in East St. Louis, where a federal judge will consider a challenge to the constitutionality of a law that is almost 2 years old and has so far withstood a barrage of challenges from gun rights advocates. The bench trial before U.S. District Judge Stephen McGlynn could be a difficult test for the ban on many semi-automatic guns, however, since McGlynn last year said the law was likely unconstitutional, following a hearing over a request by plaintiffs seeking to temporarily block the ban from being enforced. McGlynn issued a preliminary injunction on the ban, but the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago subsequently issued a stay on that ruling. The appeals court then, in November, rejected an argument that the law violates the Second Amendment rights of residents and ruled that states and municipalities have a strong likelihood of success in defending their gun bans. However, the court made clear that its opinion dealt only with the preliminary injunctions issued by lower courts and that it was not ruling definitively on the constitutionality of the state and local laws at issue in the case. Some believe the law could ultimately land before the U.S. Supreme Court. Dan Eldridge, president of Federal Firearms Licensees of Illinois, an advocacy group for gun dealers that has been part of the litigation, expressed confidence that this week's hearing will be an important step toward the ban ultimately being struck down. "We're the masters of the subject matter expertise here," said Eldridge, who owns Maxon Shooter Supplies, an indoor range in Des Plaines. "We do anticipate a win along with a significant record that's going to come out of that trial." The gun rights proponents, which also include the National Shooting Sports Foundation, a firearm industry trade organization, and the Illinois State Rifle Association, have relied heavily on the landmark 2022 case of New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, in which the U.S. Supreme Court established a new constitutional standard holding that gun laws today shall be historically consistent with laws on the books in the 18th century when the Second Amendment was codified. The National Shooting Sports Foundation has cited Bruin's historical tradition test to contend that Illinois' ban on many semi-automatic guns, which require the trigger to be pulled once per round, is too broad because it prohibits guns that are commonly used by law-abiding citizens. The organization has noted there have been more than 24 million so-called modern sporting rifles in circulation in the U.S. since the early 1990s, including many AR-15 and AK-47 type guns that are subject to the Illinois ban. Governor J.B. Pritzker, who signed the ban into law shortly after lawmakers passed the measure in 2023, and other gun control advocates have maintained that the ban meets constitutional standards. "There are misguided judges who are making decisions that I think are inappropriate and do not hold dear public safety the way that we do," Pritzker said earlier this month at an unrelated event in Skokie. "So I am hopeful the decision will get made in mid-September the right way, but if it doesn't, that it'll get overturned by higher courts." Gun rights advocates have filed several lawsuits, both on the state and federal levels, and most court decisions have been in the favor of Pritzker's administration and Democratic Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, but not without some dissent. The April 2023 decision by McGlynn, who was appointed to the bench in 2020 by Republican President Donald Trump to grant a preliminary injunction, was overturned in November when a U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals panel by a 2-1 vote found that, quote, "at least since the founding, there has been an unbroken tradition of regulating weapons," close quote, to protect public safety, and that the state and local laws at issue stay within those boundaries. However, Judge Michael Brennan, a Trump appointee, in his minority opinion, rejected what he called the majority's, quote, remarkable conclusion that the banned weapons and attachments do not qualify as arms that fall under the rights granted by the Second Amendment, finding that they indeed do warrant constitutional protection. After the Seventh Circuit's decision in November, gun rights advocates made a consolidated appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in July declined to take up the case. But Justice Clarence Thomas, a member of the High Court's 6-3 conservative majority, said the court should take up the full case if it comes back for review and expressed deep reservations about the Illinois gun ban's constitutionality. Quote, in my view, Illinois' ban is highly suspect because it broadly prohibits common semi-automatic firearms used for lawful purposes, Thomas wrote, citing case law to justify his position. Quote, it is difficult to see how the Seventh Circuit could have concluded that the most widely owned semi-automatic rifles are not arms protected by the Second Amendment. Close quote. The Illinois gun ban was a response by lawmakers to the mass shooting at Highland Park's 4th of July parade in 2022 that left 7 people dead and dozens of others injured. Robert Crimo III was charged in the case and is still awaiting trial. He was able to obtain the Smith & Wesson M&P-15 rifle used in the shooting, a gun that is among those prohibited under the ban, after his father helped him acquire a state firearm owner's ID card more than 2 years before the shooting. Despite reports to police that Crimo III had tried to kill himself and had threatened to kill others, a so-called clear and present danger report had been filed after authorities responded to at least one incident involving him, though it wasn't retained because, according to Illinois State Police, he didn't have a firearm permit or pending application for one at the time. Since then, amid criticism from at least one top Republican in the Illinois General Assembly, the state police issued administrative rules clarifying its ability to retain clear and present danger reports even if the subject doesn't have an FOID card or a pending application on file and isn't deemed to be an imminent threat. Republicans have largely joined gun rights advocates in opposing the gun ban, which includes the requirement that anyone who owned a prohibited weapon prior to January 10, 2023, when Pritzker signed the firearms ban into law, to register the firearm with Illinois State Police. The state's ban prohibits the delivery, sale, import, and purchase of more than 100 high-powered guns, including semi-automatic rifles, shotguns, and handguns. Also banned are the delivery, sale, and purchase of magazines of more than 10 rounds for long guns and 15 rounds for handguns. Illinois' ban also prohibits any device, part, kit, tool, accessory, or combination of parts that is designed to and functions to increase the rate of fire of a semi-automatic firearm above the standard rate of fire. People who own guns covered by the law's effective date but didn't register them with the state police could be charged with a misdemeanor for a first offense and felonies for subsequent violations. Many law enforcement officials have declared that they had no intention of proactively investigating violators of the law. Over a series of public hearings, gun rights advocates expressed confusion over the registration process, particularly on what they view as varying definitions of certain firearm accessories that need to be registered. Through December 31st, 29,357 people had registered about 69,000 prohibited guns and over 42,000 accessories, according to Illinois State Police data. A little over 2.4 million Illinoisans have firearm owners' identification cards, meaning only about 1.2% of FOID card holders registered guns or accessories subject to the ban, the statistics through 2023 show. However, the true degree of compliance with the law is not possible to determine, since residents with a valid FOID card may not own guns or accessories that are subject to the ban. Eldridge, the gun shop owner with Federal Firearms Licensees of Illinois, said the ban has led to business closures and confusion over issues, including whether repaired guns outlawed under the ban can be transferred from gunsmiths to the firearm owners. This is a slow process. It's much slower than I'd anticipated. I did not realize that over a year and a half later, we would just now be getting to the trial after all the pretrial maneuvering, Eldridge said. Also on the front page, we have second attack on Trump's life raises questions. Incident sparks finger pointing, calls for answers at the Capitol by Jill Colvin with the Associated Press. An apparent attempt to assassinate former President Donald Trump as he played golf in Florida has rocked a presidential campaign already marred by violence and raised questions about how such a thing could have happened for the second time in as many months. U.S. Secret Service agents opened fire Sunday afternoon on a man who was spotted pointing an AK-style rifle through a fence while hiding in the bushes as Trump golfed at his club in West Palm Beach. The FBI described it as an apparent attempted assassination on the GOP nominee. At a Pennsylvania rally in July, Trump was grazed in the ear by a bullet when a gunman was able to gain access to an unsecured roof, unleashing a hail of bullets that left one of Trump's supporters dead and two others badly injured. While the Secret Service has grappled with how to keep Trump safe as he campaigns across the country, holding rallies that often draw thousands, less attention has focused on his protection when he is off the trail, often at his own clubs and properties. The fact that there are places along the perimeter of the property where golfers, including Trump, are visible to those standing behind the fence has long been known to law enforcement. While Trump was president, news photographers were often able to capture images of him on the greens by finding gaps in the shrubbery. While Trump's plans to golf Sunday were not part of any public schedule, on days he is not campaigning, he can often be found golfing at one of his courses. Trump International Golf Club, West Palm Beach, about a 10-minute drive from his Mar-a-Lago residence, is a favorite. One of three golf clubs he owns in Florida, it boasts 27 holes of championship golf as well as event spaces. Trump often eats lunch and holds meetings in the clubhouse between rounds. Trump had just returned from a West Coast swing that included stops in Las Vegas and Utah and had announced on social media that he would be delivering remarks Monday from Mar-a-Lago about cryptocurrency as he launches a new crypto platform. Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw noted at a briefing that because Trump is no longer in office, security protocols around the course had been loosened. He's not the sitting president. If he was, we would have had this entire golf course surrounded. But because he's not, his security is limited to the areas that the Secret Service deems possible, he told reporters. Law enforcement officials praised the work of the agents assigned to protect Trump. One agent, tasked with jumping one hole ahead of the former president to scope out potential threats, managed to spot the gunman's rifle barrel sticking out of the fence that surrounds the golf course and immediately engaged that individual, Bradshaw said. In an email to campaign staff Sunday night, senior campaign advisors Chris LaCivita and Susie Wiles credited the Secret Service for saving Trump, who had praised the agents in his own protective detail for their bravery as they rushed on stage to protect him in Butler, Pennsylvania. President Trump and everyone accompanying him are safe thanks to the great work of the United States Secret Service, they wrote. Unlike other past presidents and typical VIPs who live in private residences with tall fences or in gated communities, Trump has his official residence at his Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach. The club is open to dues-paying members who mingle with the former president at meals and at events and who can invite their own guests to the property. Many nights, Trump holds court on the club's patio, playing DJ with his iPad. While president, he once plotted a response to a North Korean missile launch from the candlelit terrace, the meeting captured and posted on social media by a club member. The club is also a popular Palm Beach venue and hosts a constant stream of fundraisers, weddings, and other events that sometimes see Trump drop by unannounced. Secret Service spokesperson Anthony Guglielmi said in a social media post that the agency is working closely with the FBI, Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, and other law enforcement to investigate what happened. Trump was to be briefed in person on Monday by Acting Secret Service Director Ronald Rowe about the investigation, according to a person familiar with the plan who was not authorized to speak publicly. The incident sparked immediate finger-pointing and calls for answers on Capitol Hill. New York Representative Elise Stefanik and the House Republican Conference Chair and a close ally of the former president said she was grateful Trump was safe. Quote, "However, we must ask ourselves how an assassin was allowed to get this close to President Trump again," close quote. The leaders of the bipartisan task force that has been investigating the security failures in Pennsylvania said they were monitoring the situation and had requested a briefing from the Secret Service. "We are thankful that the former president was not harmed, but remain deeply concerned about political violence and condemn it in all of its forms," said Representative Mike Kelly, a Republican from Pennsylvania, and Representative Jason Crow, a Democratic Republican from Colorado, in a joint statement. Meanwhile, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, one of Trump's rivals in the GOP primary, said his state will conduct its own investigation. "The people deserve the truth about the would-be assassin and how he was able to get within 500 yards of the former president and current GOP nominee," he wrote in a social media post. Democratic Representative Ro Khanna echoed that message. "Two assassination attempts in 60 days on a former president and the Republican nominee is unacceptable. The Secret Service must come to Congress tomorrow and tell us what resources are needed to expand the protective perimeter, and let's allocate it in a bipartisan vote on the same day." President Joe Biden said in a statement that he was relieved that Trump was unharmed and said, "There is no place for political violence or for any violence ever in our country." He said he had directed his staff to continue to ensure that Secret Service has every resource, capability, and protective measure necessary to ensure the former president's continued safety. Now we'll turn to more local news, where we have lane closures in Normal set for Tuesday by Matus Janique. Starting at 4 a.m. Tuesday, Aaron Drive between Parkside Road and Dreyer Court, as well as University Street between Beaufort Street and Hovey Avenue, will have lane closures for pavement repair. Both lane reductions are expected to be completed by noon Tuesday, weather permitting. Drivers are urged to use caution when traveling through the areas. And if you want to find maps highlighting the reductions, they are at arcg.is/14EZLJL. Or you can call 309-454-9638 for more information. Joe Holloman with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch writes, "Budinski calls for quicker fix to Metro East traffic issue. Yet another case of TikTok to the rescue. After a video posted on the social media site picked up a viral, qualifying 40 million views, U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, a Democrat from Springfield, is asking for a little roadside assistance. The issue specifically is the exit number 16 on westbound Interstate 64 at O'Fallon, Illinois. A video posted last month shows the traffic on the exit to be so backed up that the line of cars either waiting to make a right turn to go to O'Fallon or a left turn to travel to Shiloh stretches back onto the interstate. Budzinski, whose 13th congressional district includes all or part of Macoupin, St. Clair, Madison, Sangamon, Piatt, Macon, and Champaign counties, wrote to the Illinois Department of Transportation Secretary Omer Osman, requesting the department's assistance to alleviate the traffic snarl. "The confusion and congestion at this interchange creates a dangerous situation for local drivers and impedes the flow of traffic," she wrote to Osman, adding that she was grateful to the local resident who shared their experience on this exit on TikTok. The TikTok post not only picked up 40 million viewers, it also prompted 5.2 million likes and more than 13,000 comments. The state's master plan calls for the expansion of the interstate in O'Fallon between Green Mount Road and Illinois Route 158, which also includes work on the exit. Plan for future improvements considered, Budinski asked Osman to give the highway plan some gas and expedite it, and expedite the implementation of a solution for that area. Brendan Dennison writes, REO Speedwagon bassist won't rejoin tour, which will stop in Bloomington Normal. Bruce Hall to miss November 9th Bloomington show, band to cease touring in 2025. Months before, REO Speedwagon was set to take the Grossinger Motor Arena stage in Bloomington. The classic rock band announced their longtime bass player, Bruce Hall, will not rejoin them, and the group will cease touring in 2025. In a Monday statement posted to REO Speedwagon's website, the band said Hall had intended to be back on the road again by now. In a November 2023 statement, the band decided the best thing for Hall would be to stop touring, rest his body at home, and prep for his upcoming back surgery and rehabilitation. The consensus opinion was that he had not recovered sufficiently to be able to perform at the level the fans have come to expect, the band stated Monday. Bruce respected that opinion and is grateful that Matt Bissonette has been around to keep the wagon rolling through the summer tour. Bruce never had any intention of retiring or walking away from the band fans and crew he has loved from the band fans and crew he has loved for almost 50 years. For frontman Kevin Cronin's part, the statement added, Cronin also never had any intention of leaving the band, the crew, and their fans. Due to this complex situation, irreconcilable differences arose between Bruce and Kevin, the statement continued. And as a result, REO Speedwagon announced they will cease touring effective January 1, 2025. In a Facebook post, Hall said he never thought it would end like this, and I'm heartbroken. He said he and keyboardist Neil Doughty did everything they could to keep the wagon rolling. Addressing fans, Hall said they have been very vocal and clear in their wishes for him to return to the stage. Trust me, that's all I wanted too. We all deserved a farewell tour. REO Speedwagon will perform with Loverboy on November 9th at the Grossinger Motors Arena at 101 South Madison Street in Bloomington. Doors will open at 6:30 and the show is at 7:30. Tickets start at $36.50 and are available at Ticketmaster.com. In a story from Decatur, we hear jury hears boy died from shaken baby injuries 10 years later. State's attorney to consider possible murder charges. A coroner's jury decided Monday that a 10-year-old Decatur boy's July 23rd death was a homicide after an autopsy said the adopted child finally succumbed to complications from terrible injuries suffered when he was shaken and beaten as a 4-month-old baby by his biological father. The Decatur Police Department has already reinvestigated the death as a homicide, and now the question of what happens next in the tragic case of Sebastian J. Cuttle rests with Macon County State's Attorney Scott Reuter. He told the Herald and Review his office would be carefully reviewing the autopsy report from Bloomington-based forensic pathologist Dr. Scott Denton. Reuter said he will then face the tricky legal question of whether he can bring murder charges in a new case against Sebastian's natural father, Jared E. Seymour, now 42, and his mother, Isabella M. Morgenroth, 39. She had failed to seek help for her son after he was injured. They had both pleaded guilty in Macon County Circuit Court to committing aggravated battery on their newborn baby in May of 2014. Police investigating the case said Sebastian had suffered severe head and bodily injuries after being shaken, beaten, and bitten. There had also been a gap of a week before any attempt was made to get him medical help. Seymour was sentenced to 24 years to be served at 85% and remains incarcerated at the Big Muddy Correctional Center. Morgenroth was sentenced to 6 years at 85%, but she has been paroled. Obviously, what we have to be able to show is that the minor's current cause of death relates squarely back to the injuries suffered and not some intervening cause, said Reuter. That is really what the issue is going to be, and we're looking into it. Asked how unusual it would be for essentially a shaken baby case to result in murder charges 10 years later, Reuter said it's not unprecedented nationally. But obviously, it doesn't happen with frequency, and in Macon County, I don't know that we've ever handled a case where there has been that long of a time between the injury and the passing of the victim. The autopsy evidence presented to the Macon County Coroner's Inquest from Dr. Denton had left jurors with little doubt about how Sebastian had died. Reading from the pathologist's report, Macon County Coroner Michael E. Day said the child had been killed by a combination of bacterial sepsis and bronchial pneumonia, medical conditions linked to the traumatic injuries he suffered all those years ago. Day said Denton had carried out research into such delayed deaths resulting from shaken baby injuries and found 5 recorded cases in the Netherlands, although the period between injuries and death was not as long as the Sebastian case. So in other words, it would appear that the chief pathologist here is making a statement that if this child would not have suffered severe head trauma in the past, he probably would not have developed these 2 conditions, sepsis and pneumonia, Day told the jury. In earlier testimony, Juvenile Division Detective James Wrigley had testified that Sebastian had received loving care from his adoptive family. The jurors heard how Sebastian needed round-the-clock support, could not speak, was fed through a tube, and had cerebral palsy. Damage to his spine had left the boy in constant pain, and he had been due to undergo surgery to try and relieve this discomfort when he suddenly developed the afflictions that resulted in his death. And we'll finish with today's flick fact. While many think Bloomington's storied Franklin Park, one of the Twin Cities' oldest, was named after Benjamin Franklin, it actually was named after Franklin Price, a Bloomington mayor in the 1860s when the park was created. Thus, if other parks in Bloomington and Normal had followed suit and been named by first names instead of last names, do you know what today in Bloomington Normal would be Robert, James, Daniel, David, and Walt Parks? Well, that'd be today's Robert McGraw Park, James Miller Park and Zoo, Daniel O'Neill Park, David Anderson, formerly Ash Park, and Walt Bittner Parks. And thanks to Bob Bradley at the Illinois State University, Professor Emeritus. And with that, we conclude the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, September 17th, 2024. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.